Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Adusk, will be here for the second and third segment of the program today, joined by James Corbett of the Corbett Report. But first, let's get to the markets for Thursday, June 2nd, 2016. It was a little bit of a quiet day in the gold market today. Also here in Discount Gold and Silver, graduations are taking place. I went to a high school graduation last night. My cousin's son graduated, and a lot different from when I graduated. So it was an interesting, and I didn't realize that some of these schools, and it kind of makes you wonder. It's impressive. There was over 300. 12th graders, and I don't mean to go on about this. I want to get to the metals market, but 87% of the graduates last night are going to college, whether it be a 4-year or a 2-year school. But 87%, I was impressed with that. With the 13% just going into the work market, so I was impressed by that, and the millions of dollars that these kids received. I was very impressed. I mean, you're probably talking about $20 million that these kids got in scholarships. I'm sure a lot of them included the 4 years and so forth in a graduating class of, 300 and some. I was impressed. And they want to go to school for free? They want to... they want to vote for Bernie so they get free college education. Anyway, it's just another sign of the times and party to the illusion. But it was a very nice commencement, and we are all proud. He is going to be going to Penn State for his fourth year and a major in music. Anyway, gold today. As I said, it was a quiet day in the metals market. Everybody comes to a stop right before what they consider to be the most important piece of data for the month, and of course that will be released tomorrow, and that is the May non-farm payrolls. That forecast is to come in at 160, so we'll see some action tomorrow. if it's lower, you'll see gold rise. If it's higher, you'll see gold go down. So it's a sort of a what we come to expect the first week of each month. So gold down 240 today at 1210. Again, early market trading, it was higher up to 1217, 1130. European markets close, and they're able to come in and drop the price. Silver was up 4 cents, 1607. Platinum was down 13 at 961. Palladium was also down 13 at 537. USDX today up 0.15 at 95.53. Crude oil basically unchanged from yesterday, 48.98. We'll talk a little bit about the OPEC in Vienna. What they did or didn't do. The markets, the Dow, 48.89 to the upside at 17,838. You have the NASDAQ up 19 points, 4,971, and the S&P was up 5, 2105, did get over that 2100 level. 10-year yield down 0.04 at 1.81%. The euro was down bigger than what the dollar was up, 1.12. Down 0.29. Japan, again, another heavy hit there, almost 2.5% to the downside. We talked about the the U.S. ADP, that's the National Employment Report, that was released today. Came in at 173,000, kind of in line of what was the expectations, and again, didn't have any much impact on the markets. Again, everyone is waiting for the forecast tomorrow. European Central Bank monetary policy meeting today. They concluded there was going to be no change in interest rates. No surprise there. The ECB again warned in recent weeks that it could make further monetary policy stimulus moves to continue to try to revive the Eurozone economy. Very much the same Bernanke language. You know, we're here. We'll be accommodative. If the markets need us, we'll be there. If the financial markets need us, we'll be there. The European economies, you know, they didn't need to lower rates, but there will be a different type of a stimulus program coming from the Eurozone. The ECB, they are ready to stand to buy bonds at a negative yield. Beginning on June 8th, the banks will start buying corporate bonds, selecting notes with an investment grade from at least one ratings provider. They hope to accomplish to give a boost to the market. The ECB can buy bonds with a negative yield. So even corporate bonds are going with negative yields. It's not new, but when you have a central bank buying bonds from a corporation, from a corporate bond, yeah, it's, I don't know, it's just another sign of the times. It's that leaf in the breeze that says 2x4 floating through the air, ready to hit you in the head, saying, hey, this isn't normal. This is insanity. It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. And of course, you know, we know the global monetary system, all their stimulus is not working. Nothing is going to change the dramatic and abrupt purging of this system that we're going to experience very soon. We don't know when. Election years are, you know, they try to stabilize election year, but this is not the typical election year. So, hey, anything's off the table at this point and time. But, you know, we talk about quantitative easing. You know, some believe our government doesn't have the financial ability to provide another stimulus to the economy. I mean, the main theory behind quantitative easing, among other things, was to get and to keep interest rates low. That was accomplished. We have low rates. So even though officially quantitative easing has ended, we still have historically low rates. So in some respect, quantitative easing is still here and is still providing or trying to provide a stimulus to our economy. OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, today they broke off their meeting in Vienna without reaching any new agreements on oil production. They're going to continue a hands-off policy, and members are gradually, gradually bringing supply and demand back into balance and boosting prices. So there really is no big surprise here. You know, the cartel, they control about a third of the world's oil. They rejected the idea of a production output limit. As we've seen, you know, for 18 months, they've just kept on pumping. And, of course, it resulted in a glut. But we have seen oil prices rise about 80% over the past few months from 13-year lows when it hit, below, closer to around that $25 level. Qatar, Mohammed al-Sada, the energy minister, he says the worst is over for oil. So they think they like this $50 in oil per barrel. And so there wasn't much pressure on OPEC to think about influencing supply and demand. So they think the worst is over. Well, you know, there's still some things out there that could cause the oil prices to fall once again. What was the real reason that the rise of oil that we've seen experience in the past couple of months? What's the real reason behind it? Perhaps a rising demand in U.S., India, maybe some other major consumers was the main reason that OPEC's had a little bit of optimism. Maybe they pointed a finger to the falling production in the U.S. Maybe that's made them happy, where the output from shale formations have fallen under the weight of these collapsed prices. But, you know, at the same time that these prices were rising, remember that big fire up there in Canada? Well, they had to cap a lot of their production. Yeah, a lot of their production was north of the fires, but a lot of it was taken off the market at the same time that these prices were rising significantly. So once that oil comes back onto the market again and they start flowing regularly, you know, maybe we'll begin to see more pressure on that oil price. Also, Nigeria. Oil workers, I mean, they're always threatening a strike, but they were threatening a strike at the same time that the Canadians had to cap a lot of their oil production. So you had two things going on at the same time that oil prices were rising to 50. So is it really stronger demand from the U.S. and India and other major consumers that made the price of oil rise, or was it just the, you know, maybe a little concern from Canada, Nigeria, had a bigger influence on the price of oil? We'll see soon. The fire up in Canada, I'm sure they'll begin flowing the oil again, and we'll see if oil stays at this high $40 level. But, you know, Saudis are in bad trouble. They've provided free health care, gasoline subsidies. They pay raises to its citizens with the petroleum wealth. So they're facing a fiscal crisis. They have burned through $111 billion of reserves to plug its biggest budget deficit in a quarter century. You know, they're beginning to sell off a part of their state oil company. I mean, that was their crown jewel. That was part of what gave the people their little subsidies and their health care and their gasoline pricing or gasoline money. So, again, not a good sign that they're in a healthy, that $50 on oil is going to make their life better. I had wanted to report on this yesterday. The U.S. Virgin Islands, they're facing a fiscal stress similar to Puerto Rico. And it's like, oh, big deal, U.S. Virgin Islands. Well, remember, we also mentioned earlier in the week, that doesn't have to be a big catastrophic event. It could be that little thing that comes that just surprises everything, and maybe in addition to something else, like Puerto Rico. I got two things real quick. So the Virgin Islands, they're pretty much coming out and saying, yeah, well, you know what? Maybe we don't have to pay all of that debt back to you. know, they're very similar to Puerto Rico. They have a sliver of the population, but per person, the obligations per person is 23,000. Now there's a lot of poor people. 23,000 is, you know, you may as well be telling them that they're going to owe their obligation is $100,000. They have shared cultures, you know, with Puerto Rico, and they have similar fiscal strains, declining populations, underfunded pensions, histories of borrowing to cover budget shortfalls. Unemployment rates are twice as high as the U.S. is. So it's the same template that we see through country, all around the world. Over a period of years, you keep issuing debt to cover your operating deficits. Economies are not growing. Populations are strained. But the liabilities, they keep on growing. And eventually, it reaches an unsustainable level. Someone will have to pay. A lot of folks won't get pay when these countries begin to default on the debt that they owe. And then the other taxpayer, your taxes, would be paying for the rest of it. So you get a double whammy. So if you don't protect what you have, you'll get the double whammy. What was interesting in relation to Puerto Rico, and perhaps I should have saved this for Al tomorrow since he's the legalese in everything, but there was an annual audit that suggests that debt-laden Puerto Rico may be able to avoid some of its borrowing because politicians exceeded constitutional debt limits and their own authority. This report from MarketWatch states that some of Puerto Rico's debt may have been issued illegally, allowing the government to potentially declare the bonds invalid and courts to then decide that creditors' claims are unenforceable. When was the last time we heard anything about our debt ceiling here in the States? Has it been a year? Has it been 2 years? This report, this audit report was issued by the island's Public Credit Comprehensive Audit Commissions. And so basically what they're telling you is, hey, we went beyond, we don't owe it, we're not going to pay it. And guess who's mainly involved in this issue? It covers two most recent full faith and credit debt issues of the Commonwealth, Puerto Rico. And it goes on and tells you the year and the amount. For the years 2014-2015, it's a syndicate of banks. And guess who it's led by? No surprise here, J.P. Morgan. So money for those debt payments is not in the Commonwealth's proposed budget. So they just released their budget, and they don't even have those debt payments in there. It's telling you they're not going to pay it. The governor of Puerto Rico says this, it's simple. Either we pay Wall Street or we pay Puerto Ricans. If the legislature decides we pay Wall Street more, well, each has his responsibility. He is going to continue defending the Puerto Ricans. Money I send to Wall Street, I do not have to provide services here. So it's interesting because this is and they also reference Detroit and what the Supreme Court in litigation. And when Detroit went to court to invalidate $1.45 billion in certificates of participation debt issued by two shell companies, this debt was issued illegally. So at the very least, these creditors' claims of priority are dramatically weakened. So precedence has been set. So it's really interesting to see how these debts will be defaulted on. They're just not going to pay. So again, folks, when this happens here in the States, where are you going to be? Are you going to be protected by your gold and silver? Or are you going to be protected by the paper promises through Wall Street and your financial planner? Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. I'm out of here. Alfred will be here right after these few short breaks.
Provided strength. Indeed, the chemical compounds of thyme contain antioxidants, an effective germicide that kills whooping cough bacteria and makes breathing easier. Just imagine what you can do with thyme herb when it comes to respiratory ailments like croup, pneumonia, asthma, and sinusitis. The extra benefit of thyme herb is that it soothes the nerves and stops spasmodic coughing, so you can get some rest. Who says you don't have time to take care of yourself? Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free for thyme tincture and tea to soothe your cough and get some rest. 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International 704-875-8010 or online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. And my guest is James Corbett. He's been working in Japan and living in Japan since 2004. He started thecorbettreport.com in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, a weekly e-newsletter created by the now-deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. How's your family treating you?
Yeah, they're fine. And you'll probably hear my little girl crying at some point during the conversation, but hey, that's life.
Is she invested in the Japanese stock market or anything like that?
No, but I guess being born here, she has her share of the 250+% debt to GDP ratio that the country's mired in at the moment.
You shouldn't you shouldn't say that while she can hear.
That might make her cry harder, I guess.
Yeah, it might get her started. I got an idea running through my mind that might not be mildly, that might be mildly interesting. Political instability is a function of debt. Political instability is first premise. Political instability is growing around the world. Second premise is sovereign debt is growing around the world. Is it possible that political instability is directly proportional to sovereign, that is to say, governmental debt? Does a great debt like the national debt in the United States, does it necessarily lead to political instability, or are politics and debt two separate things that don't necessarily have to move in lockstep?
Not necessarily. I would say there is often some overlap there, but not necessarily so. So, for example, I mean, things that would support your thesis, we've seen the dissolution of Greek society over the last few years and the rioting and all of that that's taken place directly as a demonstrable and easily identifiable function of the debt that the country's in and the negotiations with the Troika and all of that nonsense. So I think that's quite a obvious case of what you're talking about. And there are other examples that we could point to that are going on now with the meltdown of Venezuela and things like that, which have to do with the government and it's shortfalls because of the oil glut, which puts it in a position of deficit that it can't dig itself out of. But those are economies that are tied in various ways to other currencies or other entities, like Greece is tied to the ECB and what it does with the euro, or Venezuela economy is tied to the U.S. dollar through which it generates its oil revenue and then has to convert into local currency. So those are specific examples, and I think that's obvious to see. But the U.S. is different. The U.S., I think, is a different political animal because the debt crisis in the U.S., the debt burden, is ridiculous. It's unsustainable. It's $19-plus trillion and growing. But the U.S. is the U.S. dollar is the world reserve currency, and the Federal Reserve can and does print as much of it as it wants at any time that it wants, or more accurately, it makes it out of nothing and then buys treasuries with it to fund the U.S. debt. So there is a crisis in the political sense right now that politicians argue over the debt ceiling and things like that, and they do shutdowns every few years to stage a dramatic thing. But that, generally speaking, other than a couple of days of Washington shutdown, which most people in America, I imagine, don't notice or are actually thankful for, does
cheer,
not create
just a celebration.
It doesn't create the same situation. Right. I mean, it doesn't create the same situation as in Greece, where people aren't getting their pension payments and whatever, and it's causing riots. I think it's a very different, I mean, obviously there's political instability in the U.S., but I don't think it's a direct function of the debt. I think that's for other reasons entirely. So I don't think it's necessarily tied, but there is obviously a relation in some economies, especially economies that are marginal economies that depend on other economies for their main ability to trade and function with the world.
You referred to the national debt as $19 trillion. Do you believe that's the official national debt? That's what they tell us they have. John Williams of ShadowStats.com has estimated it's running closer to $100 trillion. There's been a Congressional Budget Office report, and economist Lawrence Kotlemeyer, they estimate it's over $200 trillion. Do you really believe, I mean, I get that $19 trillion is the official debt. Do you accept that as real, or do you think it's minimized? They're not telling us the truth.
Right. Well, like so many other things, it comes down to the definition. So if we're talking about unfunded liabilities, things that the government has promised they will pay and do not have the money for, then yes, you can go into the hundreds of trillions probably quite easily. But if we're talking about the technical definition of debt that the U.S. government and the governments around the world are using, again, it depends on what definition you're using. I think it's probably easiest to understand debt if we use the same definition across the board for all the different governments so that we can at least make comparisons, because any definition that you come up with is going to be arbitrary to a certain extent. I mean, can you say that debt that the government has promised it will be in debt for, you know, 20 years from now is part of the current debt load? Well, yes, you can make an argument for that. You can make an argument the other way. Of course, the government wants the number to be as low as possible. So I would say $19 trillion is the smallest possible number you could come up with, depending how you define that word.
You also, if I understood you correctly, You believe that the Federal Reserve can print its way out of the debt problem by simply printing enough paper currency to cover the $19 trillion. Am I understanding you correctly?
1 quadrillion. There's no theoretical limit to what they can print. The only limit is to what the world can absorb and will accept.
And when that's where I focus on this. I look at this from the perspective of Zimbabwe. They could print all the Zimbabwean dollars they wanted. They were printing quadrillion dollar notes before they were finished. But what they can't print is public confidence in those pieces of paper. And I think that's where the Federal Reserve is. I think they're caught in a similar restriction. They can't just go, oh, we'll just print another $19 trillion. Go ahead, knock it out. Let's fire up the presses. We'll print up $19 trillion and we'll pay off the debt. I don't think they can do that without losing public confidence in the dollar. And they tell us that's what holds the dollar together, is public confidence.
Yes. I mean, you're right. It is a game of perception. And the fundamental perception question is, will there be anyone at the table to buy U.S. treasuries? And so far, there are. There are still people to buy treasuries. In fact, China has effectively unloaded $780 billion of its U.S. treasury holdings over the past 2 years. And that has made absolutely no dent whatsoever in the treasury market. There is still a lack of liquidity and not enough treasuries to go around. People are still clamoring to buy treasuries. So make of it what you will, but they're winning the perception.
It's a mystery, that's for sure. There's a lot of room for making it what you will, and a lot of different opinions on what's happening here. It's certainly a mystery, but... It's not clear what's happening, and that creates a lot of opportunity to speculate, which I enjoy. So I enjoy speculation. And you're not bound by the facts, the information. You get out there and just theorize. There's another one of my notions. Inflation destroys the fiat dollar. All right. And we see evidence of that destruction in the fact that since the dollar became a pure fiat currency back in 1971, the fiat dollar has lost over 95% of its purchasing power. That's due to inflation. A dollar right now is worth less than it has the purchasing power of a nickel back in 1971. Inevitably, it will lose 96% and then 98%, finally 100% of its purchasing power. When the dollar's purchasing power is reduced by 100% or very nearly so, the fiat dollar will be dead. My point, inflation destroys the fiat dollar. What is the fiat dollar? It's the number one product produced by the Federal Reserve System. Deflation, on the other hand, destroys debtors because it forces them to repay their bills in more valuable dollars. And the net effect, you borrow $100,000, and in theory you might have to pay back, even though it'll be $100,000. You pay back the equivalent of $110,000 in purchasing power if there were 10% deflation. Now, deflation is good for debtors. And our government is certainly one of, if not the biggest debtor in the world. Our government should hate deflation. But deflation,
yes,
should be...
I think
you said
that wrong, but yes, you're right. Deflation is
I think
bad
I did
for
too.
Debtors. Right.
Deflation destroys debtors. But deflation, in theory, should be good for the Federal Reserve System. It makes their dollars more valuable and likely to last longer. Inflation will take them down to zero and destroy them. Deflation will raise them from a nickel to a dime, maybe even a quarter someday, in terms of purchasing power. That helps to sustain. So where I'm going with this, it appears to me that the Federal Reserve has a vested interest in promoting deflation, makes their product more valuable. Right? And the federal government has a vested interest in promoting inflation, which reduces their debt. Does this mean that at bottom, there's an adversarial relationship between the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government? They're no longer, not necessarily accomplices in the same conspiracy, but they're working kind of together, but maybe they've hit the end of the line on this. Are these adversaries or are they co-conspirators?
I see what you're saying. But actually, I think they are working together conspiratorially. I think they are kind of different arms of the same organ or different organs of the same way. You know what I'm saying. Anyway.
I do, and it appears to me that the Federal Reserve, we talk about it being an independent entity, but the truth is it's being sacrificed by inflation.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, but it relies on the idea that money is that U.S. Federal Reserve notes is a commodity that is inherently scarce or is at least theoretically limited to some degree, but it isn't. As we've seen over the past 8 years now, it's 8 years, can you believe it? Since Lehman collapse, the Federal Reserve has expanded its balance sheet by, what, $3
trillion? Three and a half, I think.
Again, they just create that, and there's nothing stopping them from creating another three or 30 or 300. Again, it's the perception problem. So the Federal Reserve notes are not a commodity in that sense. They are not scarce. They are not limitable. So the Federal Reserve doesn't care about the value of the dollar in that sense. It's not like it's trying to purchase things with its dollars and trying to maintain that. Theoretically, what the system is supposed to do is have a nice, small, steady growth, inflation, growth in the money supply to accommodate a steadily growing society. That's the idea, and that's what they're trying to maintain. And that is supposed to be so that everyone in the economy can function. They can use their dollars, and they can expect to be able to, you know, purchase things with the dollars that they're earning. But there's that inflation incentive for them to get investing in the stock market and things like that. So, that's the theory of all of this. The Federal Reserve doesn't really care about its Federal Reserve notes because, again, it prints them out of nothing at any time it wants in whatever amount it wants.
Well, I get that, but still, if the dollar, as inflation persists, and we go from its having lost 95% to 96, and then 97, 98, it points to the end, the demise of the dollar, and not so far from now. It's lost 95% since 1971.
Well, I think the perspective
45 years or thereabouts, lost at that rate. Well, we're going to lose another 2%. We don't have many more years left. And what does the Federal Reserve do if the dollar becomes worthless?
Right. Well, firstly, I believe that 95% of purchasing power drop is since 1913, not 1971. I've generally heard
If you calculate in terms of gold.
Oh, okay.
You can make the case since 1971, 1913. Everybody looks at that, but for me, but whatever it is, we are still 95%. However, if it's lost over 95%, this is a trend.
I think the way to look at this is from the macro perspective of what the Federal Reserve is, which is the state sanctioned, the government approved, sanctioned. It's got the seal of the authority of government, but it's really what it is at base is an oligopoly of the main central bank, the main banks, the main private commercial banks. They are the ones that run it. They are the ones that comprise the membership of the Federal Reserve System. It is just basically the banks banding together to set the interest rate and basically overseeing the economy, which sounded like a great idea in 1913 for some reason. So that's what they are.
It may have been a great idea. It may have even been a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, again,
particularly when the currency was still backed by gold and silver.
Right. Well, okay, but the point of this is that, so the banks are looking out for their own interests. The mechanism that they have to make not just money, but actual wealth, is to expand credit, make a big credit bubble, get everybody involved in it, get everyone investing and buying houses or whatever, and then to collapse the bubble and shear the sheep and take the real assets that underlie that made-up wealth, take that from them, and that's the game. Shearing the sheep making the bubble, making everybody happy, contracting the bubble. And that's been going on for a very long time, as people know, and that is how the bankers make the money. So I think that what the Federal Reserve System, if it has an intent like that, it really is to make sure that that bubble machine keeps going. The bubble goes, and then it pops, and it goes, and it pops, and it goes, and it pops. And it keeps people well enough that they're not going to riot with pitchforks storming on D.C., but it also keeps the bankers very happy because they get to shear the sheep in regular intervals.
Then you're anticipating a shearing is approaching. The moment of shearing is approaching. Do you have any idea how soon we might get there?
Well, I can't really make those types of predictions, but I think we might be getting to the point where they might not have control over the ability to decide whether it will happen today or tomorrow kind of thing. I think we might be getting to the point where the system becomes unbalanced in a way that the bubble has to be expanded to a crazy extent, or if they lose control of that lever, it will collapse. So I don't think it's a 100% complete control mechanism that they have, the lever that they can just pull. And I think it's getting further and further out of their control.
Let's talk more about whether what the nature of that imbalance might be when we return. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. I'm Alfred Addisk here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, CORBETT.com. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
The aspirin mistake. Aspirin was discovered by mistake during World War II and suppresses your immune system and prevents blood clotting. Don't expose your body to risk when you can use a natural inflammation and pain reliever called Extra Strength Pain Relief by Apothecary Herbs. Discover the power this formula has with salicin to enter the system in 60 seconds to work hard and relieve pain for 12 hours. Whether it's arthritis, sports injury, or flu, you can relieve aches, pain, and swelling with our Extra Strength Pain Relief formula. Call Apothecary Herbs now, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97%. Of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We're talking about the Federal Reserve and how this monetary system operates. And we've been talking about inflation and how it is intended to stimulate the economy, and that might be a good thing. But we also talk about the possibility that the Federal Reserve and the powers that be are no longer really in control. Maybe there's an imbalance taking place that has exceeded their ability to correct or manage. We're going to start to wonder now, what is the nature of that imbalance? And let me suggest one possible explanation. See if you agree or not. If we're inflating the currency, and that's what they want to do, it's certainly been their policy for years and years, and that's how the dollar is devalued from 100 cents to a dollar to a nickel on a dollar in terms of purchasing power. Inflation is what they apparently want. That inflation helps borrowers and consumers to borrow more money and spend it, to buy more things to allegedly stimulate the economy, but it allows them to repay their debt with cheaper dollars. but it also robs creditors. Are creditors the adults, the big boys in this situation, who can afford 2% or 3% robbery every year, and they're still smart enough to continue to profit, or are they jeopardized by inflation? And perhaps, and what happens if we lose them? Is that the imbalance that you were at least hinting at when we closed the first part of the program?
Well, that wasn't quite the way I was thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I would say that the banks are not in that type of danger at this moment, that that would be the reason they would shut down the spigot of credit. And they have shut down the spigot of credit, but as we've talked about, I think, before on this program, one of the reasons for that is because the Fed has started paying them to park their reserves at the Fed. So if they get paid effectively to park their reserves, they're going to be less willing to lend those reserves out for, doubtful returns. So that has created a sort of, glut in the market in terms of the declining velocity of money. But the way that
so
I
you're
look
saying
at it is,
that something's going on right now, that even though they claim to be stimulating the economy by essentially withdrawing that money from the economy and keeping it in the overnight holding facility of the Federal Reserve or wherever, that they're not stimulating the economy.
Not directly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that's part of the problem in terms of what they put forward, the language and the rhetoric that we use to describe what the Federal Reserve is doing versus what they actually are capable of doing. And as we talked about back when the Fed raised their target interest rate back in December, again, people imagine that they have some lever. They just decide, okay, now the interest rate is this. Well, no, they have a target rate. And how do they target that? Well, they have different mechanisms that they can use to try to encourage banks to lend at a certain rate, and they measure whether or not that's actually working. But those tools that they have are quite blunt instruments, and there's only so much that they can do with them. And I think one of the ways that we can see that is that one of the main ways that we look at what is happening in terms of people's investment patterns is we look at, say, the stock market indices and compare them to treasury rates. And as treasury rates decline, people are more and more investing in bonds and as a type of investment. They think that's a good idea. So rates decline. Rates will rise, which would get people investing out of bonds and into the stock market where they can see bigger returns. Now, that is an interesting mechanism, but it has a limit. Theoretically, it used to have a limit, i.e. 0%. You can't go below a 0% interest rate. Well, actually, now they're starting to try to do that. But that, I think
that's new
shown,
math. This is just a result of new math.
Exactly. Now you'll pay us to invest in these instruments. But I think that shows the fact that tool is becoming useless. It doesn't have the effect that it used to. And when you look at the treasury markets,
a contrary effect from this perspective. Historically, when they tinkered with the interest rate in this country, particularly when we had a gold or silver based currency, there was no place for the dollar. If you were a creditor and you had money that you were willing to lend and they reduced an interest rate and you said, damn those people, still you had two choices. You could let your gold and silver sit there and gain nothing, or you could lend it and gain something, even though if it wasn't what you thought was fair. That was because we were surrounded by two oceans, and it was not easy for the people who had credit to move their wealth to foreign countries that paid higher interest rates. But today, that's not the case. We have a digital currency that can circle the globe at the speed of light. And if they push interest rates down to zero or below, what's to keep the creditors from just saying, well, to heck with that. I'll go lend my money into South Africa, to Brazil or someplace in the
right.
third world.
Yeah.
And make
yeah.
The money is no longer trapped the way that it was a take it or leave it situation for creditors yeah. once upon a time. That's no longer the case. If the creditor says, this interest rate, this is stupid. I'm not lending my money out for just a couple of percent. I've got to get a decent return. Then
and
we lose
exactly
the money
right.
supply.
Yeah.
The money yeah. supply is reduced every time they think we're stimulating the economy by reducing the interest rate. They're actually cutting the money supply. driving currency out of the country, which should slow the economy. Do you understand it? Do you agree or disagree?
Oh, yes. And that's a spot on analysis. And that's exactly what's happened over the last several years, is that a lot of this money that's been generated has actually gone overseas into looking for some type of actual return, because you're not getting returns in the bond or treasuries at this point. They're down to historic lows. So there have been more investors going offshore into developing emerging markets where you can get 10 or 15%, or at least the promise of that. And that's exactly where a lot of the money has gone. And that's exactly why, when the Fed started talking about ending QE and then started talking about raising their target rate and then actually raised their target rate, all of those events had a significant effect on the unwinding of that process. A lot of that money coming back from overseas, coming back into the U.S. So does this
explain what's happened to the economy in Brazil, for example, our third world economies? Were they stimulated over the course of the last 5 or 8 years by the influx of dollars looking for higher interest rates? And have they been damaged and destimulated by the dollars saying, nope, we're going home now?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things going on in Brazil. That's one of them. But yes, I mean, I think globally speaking, we can see that in a number of different markets. And we've seen, for example, people might remember the Indian rupee crisis from a couple of years ago, which again was which was very much precipitated by the Fed and their lowering of QE and their eventual stopping and unwinding of that program, absolutely had a direct effect on what was going on in India at that time, for example. So, I mean, these effects are real, they're measurable. And they're understood by people in the emerging markets who get this flood, this slosh of money coming in and then going out. And it's like a wave. And of course, it generally doesn't. It might benefit some people for a short period of time. But in the end, it's really only the people who are moving the money who really benefit from it.
We talked a little earlier about the banker's idea is to create these bubbles and then pop them and shear the sheep. We look at it from the perspective of, oh my gosh, the bankers are going to shear we the sheep here in the United States. But have they already started shearing? Have they already implemented this program by moving currency, reduced interest rates? They knew it would drive currency to foreign countries. It would stimulate the foreign countries. They'd pull the plug, and then were the bankers intent on shearing Brazil? Did what happened to Brazil, is this just an unintended consequence, or was it something they planned from the beginning? Said, we'll just reduce interest rates over here in the United States. The money will flow out to third world nations. We'll let it go for a while. We'll bring the money back in. And when we do, collapse them and buy their property for a dime on the dollar. Is that part of the shearing process, or just an unintended consequence?
Well, I mean, I think we shouldn't simplify it too much. It's not like there is a single bank with a single mind making these decisions. It's a lot of different competing banks that have similar interests but don't always, you know, agree. So, for example, you can look specifically at the way Goldman Sachs cooked the books for Greece to get them into the Eurozone in the first place, which was a fraud, a massive fraud, that was really designed just to earn some extra money for Goldman Sachs. I don't think they were necessarily thinking about the long-term economic and political ramifications for Greece and the euro in particular, but it is one of the consequences of that, and probably a foreseeable one, but I'm not sure that was the motivation for what they were doing there. So with Brazil and other things, you know, other places like that, I think it's probably similar. The one way that I would look at this on the macro level is to say that, well, if it is perfectly understood and predictable that this money is going to slosh around into emerging markets and come out, and that kind of tidal wave is going to destabilize a lot of places internationally, and it will make it hit home even further how international the financial system is at this moment in time, that does serve the interests of people who want to create, deepen, and enhance the international framework for dealing with financial and monetary matters. So, for example, of course, in the wake of Lehman, we saw the G20 in London in April 2009, and they were all talking about, oh, we need a new world order and all of this. And they created, or at least expanded, the Financial Stability Board, and which is creating all these rules about bank bail-ins and everything behind the scenes that no one's ever heard of, because what's the FSB? I don't know. It's some kind of subset of the BIS. What's the BIS? Who cares? It just gets lost in the bureaucratic framework. But it is the necessary justification for the creation of that international architecture. So if there is a grand design behind this, I think it would be more along those lines. I don't know if it's targeting specific countries, and maybe it is, but I think the bigger scheme of this, the bigger picture, is the destabilization itself is used as the lever through which these organizations can pivot and make bigger and bigger bigger organizations that, of course, they, again, control. The BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, it's just the Federal Reserve writ large, writ globally, and it is controlling so much of the type of banking regulations that are coming in internationally now.
We have about 3 minutes left, and maybe four. I'm curious about Israel. For most of my lifetime, Israel seems like it was in the news almost every day. That's an exaggeration. That's not true. But still seems like that. Israel, Israel, Israel. For the last 6 months, we haven't heard much about Israel. Here is an article from The National, which is a Jewish publication, and it says, religious zealots waging a quiet revolution in Israel. And they're complaining a man named Benjamin Netanyahu has forced out his long-serving defense minister, Moshe Yaalon. As he stepped down, Mr. Yaalon said, extremist and dangerous elements have taken over Israel. What is going on in Israel? Is there anything mysterious happening there, or they've just kind of calmed down a little bit?
There is a genuine phenomenon taking place, and in fact, I just wrote about this in the Forecaster, so people can go to theinternationalforecaster.com, and as we speak, it's currently on the homepage. 200 former Israeli security officials push Palestinian peace plan. Talking about a pretty interesting development, you had this group of 200, there were former Israeli military and various security officials from Mossad and Shin Bet and Israel police, that put forward this proposal for ending the impasse with the Palestinians that includes accepting the Arab Peace Initiative and conceding East Jerusalem to a future Palestinian state and stopping freezing the settlement building. Now, this is interesting because it really is kind of a slap in the face, not just to Netanyahu, but to the kind of coalition that he's forming right now, the far-right coalition, because as you say, they just ousted Yaalon and replaced him with the chairman of the far-right group Israel Beitenu, who's Avigdor Lieberman. And this is seen as a slap in the face to the military, because you've had some generals and people in the military going off script, so to speak, in the last couple of months with some interesting statements. For example, you had the Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Gadi Eisenkot, who was actually saying that the Israel military needs moral standards and shouldn't be emptying magazines into Palestinian girls brandishing scissors. And of course, that became a controversial statement. How can you humanize a Palestinian? Or you had Major General Yair Golan make these comments that were seen as comparing modern Israel to 1930s Germany, which obviously, you know, upset a lot of people in Netanyahu, and it became a big political thing. So the military has been more and more at least seen to be a sort of pushing back against this far right turn in Israeli politics. So the politicians are getting back against the military.
They're trying not to be extremist. If I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that the military is rejecting an extremist role, and they are looking for something like a more humane military. Is that?
Oh, that seems to be at least something that's in the air right now. And it makes sense, because if you're in the military and you're commanding these people and you're on the front line fighting these fights for the politicians, maybe you see that fight from a very different perspective than someone sitting in a comfortable chair. And of course, who gets the immediate backlash from these is it's the military. So, of course, the military is looking out for its own interests, but that does make it a sort of moderating influence. And although it's always had this element to it, I think it's more perceptible the further to the right that the politicians shift. So it's an interesting development. And I've got a few links there in the Forecaster article for people who are interested in reading more about that.
All right, James, thanks very much. Always appreciate having you on the program. Look forward to talking to you again next week. Good luck with your newborn son and your little daughter. She didn't cry at all during the program. She must be comforted by the sound of your voice. I'm Alfred Addisk, ladies and gentlemen, and this is James Corbett, my guest, and we will be back in a week. And in the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody Cedarstrom, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.